Interesting story out of the Sacramento Bee, the newspaper there. Wendell Phillips was a newly minted Sacramento sheriff's deputy when the man known as the East Area Rapist was breaking into homes, stalking and raping dozens of victims night after night over the course of several terrifying years in the region. Phillips, who is now 68, said one thing that stands out to him as he looks back on the case, which had him hiding in darkened homes. This is Phillips now who is doing this. Face covered in grease paint, trying to catch the suspect in the act. He remembers thinking that the man they were hunting behaved like a cop or someone who had been in the military. It was something he discussed with his fellow deputies. We always suspected he was law enforcement or had some kind of special forces training or both, said Phillips, a former deputy union representative who is now an attorney living in Malibu. Those long-held suspicions were confirmed, of course, when officials named Joseph James D'Angelo as a suspect in the long, cold case. 72 years old, a Folsom High School graduate, enlisted in the U.S. Navy, went on to serve in Vietnam. Later earned a bachelor's degree in criminal justice from Sacramento State University. After graduation, he moved to Exeter, where he served as a police officer from 73 to 76. And his time there coincided with what became known as, we just mentioned, the Visalia Ransacker burglary spree, in which someone broke into more than 85 homes, killed a College of the Sequoias journalism professor, 10 miles from Exeter. After leaving Exeter in 1976, D'Angelo became an officer with the Auburn Police Department. Fired, as we mentioned, in 79, he was charged with shoplifting a hammer and a can of dog repellent from a Citrus Heights drugstore. Someone just emailed me and said the reason he stole it is because they didn't want any record that he had purchased it in case they were caught at the scene of the crime. Unbelievable story. In a moment, we will be back in a moment with Keith Komos. We'll talk more about the case, and we'll take your calls on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Keith Komos with us, co-author of the book Case Files of the East Area Rapist and the Golden State Killer. We'll get to your calls as well this hour. Keith, interesting that this Wendell Phillips fellow believed that it was military or police.
Yeah, the way the offender was so organized and the way that he stalked an area and attacked, he was clearly a tactician of some kind. And you look back, and hindsight's 20/20, and you look back and you say, okay, this guy, they thought he had law enforcement background, so why not investigate law enforcement members? Well, a lot of them were investigating each other, and every law enforcement member had fingerprints on file, so they were hoping for a match between, because at East Area Rapist scenes, there were fingerprints found, but none of them matched each other, and none of them matched any fingerprints that they knew of. So you also look at the military angle. Well, this guy obviously had some kind of training. He was in good physical condition. He was sometimes seen crawling on the ground, just like they do in the military.
Yep. Hiding in bushes, right?
Hiding in bushes, and he would wait for so long. He would approach a house, and he would rap on a window or scratch a screen and wait to see if there was any response. Or he would wait, and he would watch the residents. Sometimes a neighbor would hear a dog barking furiously at 10 p.m. The attack wouldn't occur until 2:30 a.m. So he was in the vicinity for a long time, and that's not normal behavior seen in offenders, but
no.
That is sometimes seen in the military. So you look back and you say, okay, well, they knew he had military background, or they thought that he did. Well, this was the end of the Vietnam era, and there were a lot of people with military backgrounds. And we're talking about Sacramento at the beginning of the series. There were several Air Force bases, Mather Air Force Base and McClellan Air Force Base were the two closest. And this area where he was offending, there was military roots and military culture through and through. And it really didn't narrow the suspect pool down a whole lot. So it's easy to look at this and say, okay, well, you know, military, law enforcement. Well, those were things that got persons of interest and suspects put higher on the list as opposed to people who didn't have those backgrounds. But it wasn't unique enough for this offender to stand out.
Let's go to the calls now. East of the Rockies, Steve in Waterbury, Connecticut is with us. Hi, Stephen. Good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen. I have a theory about this guy, and I have a story, too. I'd like
sure.
to hear if I could do both.
Absolutely.
I believe this guy is probably a sociopath. I don't think you're going to find him insane. But I think his biggest thing is control, and that he wanted to outsmart the police and be smarter than everybody in the world, basically, is the way I see him. Like I said, that's just a theory. I've heard of cases where if you get attacked by somebody, you kind of want to personalize it. That's why they will, like, have people, I let the bank say hello to people and stuff like that, if you guys follow that.
Mm-hmm.
But I do have a friend that she was actually attacked by a serial killer, and they found him afterwards. They called him, so they didn't know he was a serial killer. But the time she was talking to people about Christianity, and she didn't really have a belief, but when she was in the situation, she just called upon Jesus, if you're real, you got to show yourself. She said, like, this green, eerie glow entered the room, and the guy just got spooked off. So it's just
wow. And how long later did they arrest this guy?
You know, I don't have the full details. I know she moved from Texas to Connecticut because she was afraid of this guy. So I think it was, you know, sometime after the fact, but she eventually ended up moving back to Texas. So I don't have any more details. They wanted probably too much work because it wasn't, you know, something that I figured was kind of traumatic for her, you know?
Okay. As you look back at these stories, Keith, and these tips, it's kind of like, other than the name of the guy, the type of guy, it's right under their noses, isn't it?
Yeah, several of the theories did turn out to be true. Some of them didn't, but the law enforcement background, some of the things that that neighbors and acquaintances are saying about this guy as far as anger issues, but some things didn't match. This guy had a wife and he had a family. That was not completely expected based on the profiles that were given about him being unable to maintain relationships with women and having a deep-seated hatred of women so deep that he would be unable to maintain these types of relationships. So he was basically hiding in plain sight, though, in many ways, especially maintaining a geographic tie to the area. That is brazen, but that's typical of this offender. Your caller mentioned control, and a lot of the literature mentions that rape is one facet of that is control. And from the very beginning, this offender showed proclivity towards situations where he could control. He would enter a home, ransack it, and have control over certain situations and have control over how it would look, and he would move on to control what law enforcement knew about him based on what he would say to victims. He would throw out red herrings, say, oh, I am from this area, or I went to Bakersfield, and did he or didn't he? We haven't found anything yet to indicate that he did. Or he would say, don't tell people that you saw my van, and there was no van associated with that particular attack. So he wanted to control the narrative. He wanted to control his victims.
Well, and the fact that he had the male spouse in the room tied up.
That's the ultimate
that's
control.
Weird.
This guy was, the men would be tied up, face down, pillows and blankets on their heads.
He put dishes on their back and said, if I hear the dishes fall, I'm going to kill you.
This guy got off on control and the fear that he would instill in his victims. And that is very depraved and very sick.
Yep, absolutely. Absolutely. Strange. Let's go next to Shane, west of the Rockies in Columbus, California. Shane, go ahead, sir.
George, first time, long time.
Thank you, sir.
Hey, back in 1978, I was a junior at Exeter Union High School, where this guy was a cop at, right?
Okay.
So we had a class, and this was one of those, you know, kind of, they didn't really do this back in the 70s, but kind of technical training. So they had a sergeant from the Visalia PD come over and teach a police science class. So my dad was a cop at the time, so I took, you know, I was very interested. So I won't say his name because, you know, I would have to get his permission.
No, I understand. That's okay.
So he had training one weekend, and he said he was going to go off, and it was near the Sacramento area. Well, he came back, and I think there were five of us, you know, who were like, you know, want to be cops and everything. And he started talking about the training, and he goes, and a really weird thing happened. And we go, well, what happened? He said, met this guy. And he was, you know, I forgot what agency, but it was an agency up near Sacramento. And he was asking this officer from Visalia about the Visalia Prowler, I think they called it. There was a whole, like, from 70, like, 4 to 76 break-ins in Visalia, you know, burglaries. And that's they I think they have DNA connecting this guy to that. And my teacher said this guy approached him and had all these questions that only the cops would know. And he just thought it was really weird that this guy knew this much about these cases.
You think it was this guy?
Well, that's why I'm kind of creeped out, because I saw this today. I'm getting like chills right now, because this guy, he goes, I know this guy's a cop who's ever doing this. And so he went to, I think he went to his chief, and the chief went to the DA, and they go, that's kind of flimsy. We really can't do anything. But to this day, I still remember that conversation I had with that sergeant from Visalia PD about the guy he met near Sacramento. And that guy was a cop in Auburn until, I think, 79.
How many police officers do you think, Keith, at that time suspected this suspect and nobody did anything about it?
This particular suspect, as far as we know, has never been in the case files themselves and has never been investigated in relation to this case until this month, basically. So, and a lot of people have been investigated. The estimate is that about 40,000 persons of interest have been looked at in this case. And so he is probably in the minority of men of his demographic background as far as not having been a person of interest. So he was the unsuspected in many ways. And it's crazy to think about that he could be that close and check a few boxes and still not be investigated in the case. It really goes to show just how many bad guys there were, because people with prior offenses got priority. If you had a convicted rapist and he checked a lot of these boxes, then obviously that guy would be investigated first because he showed propensity to committing these types of crimes. But this guy has never been on the radar until now.
What makes you think that they are watching him? Well, they said he's on a suicide watch, but what makes you think they thought he would be in that position to kill himself?
The profilers all along have said that this type of offender is high risk. And some of that goes back to that control that we spoke about a little bit earlier. And
he's not in control anymore.
Right, he's not. He's behind bars. He's somebody else's prisoner. His hands are bound now. So that's a turn of the tables that this type of offender typically doesn't cope well with. Now, over age, as he aged, maybe he mellowed. Maybe he doesn't even associate that part of his life with who he is anymore. It's hard to tell this person's psychological.
How do you forget that, for crying out loud? I mean, has he found God? Who knows?
Who knows? How do you do it in the first place, much less continue to live a semi-normal life after it?
My God, if the guy's Catholic and he goes into a confessional booth and says, bless me, Father, for I have sinned. I've raped 50 people and I've killed 12. He's not going to tell him to say, take 12 Hail Marys. I mean, what do you do?
More than that.
My gosh, Zach in Clyde, Texas with us, east of the Rockies. Hi, Zach.
Hey, George, thanks for having me on again.
Of course.
Very interesting conversation tonight, especially given my profession.
Well, you're a deputy sheriff, aren't you?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Yes, sir. Marine Corps veteran, infantry, Iraq War, and I actually got a psychology degree and worked in counseling before I got into law enforcement 10 years ago.
Well, thank you for serving, Zach.
Well, thank you yourself, George. And again, as I've said before, thank you for your support. And, just to comment on the case a little bit, and as far as this guy not being on the radar and what took so long to catch him, and let my caveat be that this is all hypothetical. I have no knowledge of the case. I'm not involved in the investigation in any capacity, so on and so forth. I cannot give legal advice, et cetera, et cetera. Just let that be my caveat in case anybody that knows me is listening. But, we have a saying in law enforcement that it's not what you know, it's what you can prove. You can know something all day long, but if you can't prove it to beyond a reasonable doubt, then it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what you know, it's what you can prove. And I would think as quickly as they swooped in and caught this gentleman, once the DNA evidence was available. He probably was on their radar. They were just keeping it low key to try and catch him, because DNA is not the smoking gun that most people think it is. And it takes a mountain of other casework, especially in something like this, to support that DNA evidence.
Right.
And I would imagine, again, speaking hypothetically, if I had been an investigator on the case, I would look at this and go, okay, this guy's military, he's law enforcement, he's got to be. I know this, and this is why I know it. Now, can I necessarily prove that in a court of law? No. But even after he was terminated from the police service, I mean, George, you know as well as I do, being a veteran, you've got guys that you served with that you can call up, and that'll be there for you at a moment's notice.
Oh, absolutely.
No questions asked.
Yep.
And it's there's a lot of that in law enforcement, too. And this guy's not going to quit moving in those circles. And whether intentionally or unintentionally, just through negligence or not realizing that they're being worked, you know, guys give away a lot more information to other cops or other military members than what they realize. And if you don't... you know, if you're not careful about that, you'd have to keep him off the books. And I would just think that they probably had their suspicions and kept it for a while,
mm-hmm.
and just working on that hypothesis. But I guess my meal break's going to be cut a little bit shorter than I thought. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. Thanks for your input, too. And, Keith, it is ironic that after your book came out with Cat Winters, this guy would get caught. Timing is unbelievable.
The timing is great. And caller, thank you for your service to your country and your community. And one of the things that he touched on, he made a great point, because in order to make this type of DNA collection, what they typically have to do is prove probable cause and get it signed by a judge. And that's not always an easy thing to do. One of the main things that we read when we were compiling the book were pages and pages and pages of old probable cause statements, because some of the best evidence is actually found in there. We think this is a good suspect because this thing happened in this murder and he matches that. And we would actually find a lot of great information in those statements. So it's not an easy thing for them to always get a DNA sample that will hold up really well in a court of law. So one of the things that they're telling me as far as what led them to this suspect is that it was an advance in technology, and they've been doing a lot of things regarding forensic genealogy and familial hits. And
I think somebody ratted on him too.
It could very well be, and that's how we've always thought that this would end.
Incredibly, investigators said they believed whoever he was, he had a naval background, which he did, because he would tie his victims up with an intricate sailor's knot called a diamond knot. They knew this.
He did use that knot. He only used it in one attack, but it seemed to be sort of an off-the-cuff usage where he was almost making a statement, because that's also called a decorator's knot. And the victim he used it on was an interior decorator. So for him to know that knot, probably not knowing beforehand who he might attack that night, because sometimes in his murders, he seemed to attack opportunistically.
We're going to come back and take some final calls next with Keith Komos on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. Our final segment with Keith Komos here, author of Case Files of the East Area Rapist / Golden State Killer. With these victims, Keith, the people who had been molested or killed, any similarities there? Most serial killers have that same MO, I guess. Was there anything similar to any of these victims?
That's one of the one things that we really tried to figure out when we were researching the East Area Rapist and Golden State Killer cases. What did these people have in common? Did they know each other in any way? Did they have a similar job?
Right. Were they brunettes or blondes or whatever?
Exactly. What we found was that there were no really distinguishing characteristics among the victims. A lot of them had long hair, which was the style at the time. Some of the murder victims looked somewhat similar, but there were some that didn't look anything like the other ones also. One thing that we did notice was that none of them were overweight. They were all fit or had a fairly petite body type.
Okay, and of the 12 who were killed, what was the the sexual makeup? Men, women?
They were usually couples. There were two lone females that were killed, but they were usually couples.
So he generally killed with couples while he was going to molest the woman, I guess.
Right. He raped the woman and killed the couples.
But why did he leave so many unkilled, I guess?
Well, it was just an escalation and an evolution in his crime spree. It seemed that he was trying to work up his nerve or work up his way to killing on a regular basis, which is odd because he killed in 1975. He killed that father that we discussed last hour. He killed a couple named Brian and Katie Maggiore in 1978. And then he didn't kill again until late 1979. And the ones before 1979 were outside of the bedroom. They were outside of the home. They were basically, he was killing to avoid capture.
Right. Did any of the victims plead with him? Did they talk about that?
The survivors did plead with him quite a bit. Almost all of them were convinced that they were going to be killed. Because of the way that he was operating.
Yeah, I could see that.
Because of the anger and the violence that he seemed capable of.
Did he know any of them?
It doesn't appear that he did. There doesn't appear, at this early stage, it doesn't appear that there's any personal connection between the killer and his victims, which is one of the reasons that he stayed free for so long, because he avoided that personal connection. Now, one may come out later. And one thing that we discovered when we were researching the Visalia Ransacker case is that there were several ties between the victims. One researcher named Mason that works with us discovered that one weekend he attacked a doctor, and then later on in that weekend he attacked the doctor's assistant. So, or not attacked, but he burglarized their homes.
Huh.
So, and then
I wonder if he was a patient of theirs.
It very well could be, and because he lived nearby. And as we looked into that, we found burglary victims that knew each other, and that he was obviously stalking the teenage daughters.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of that going on in the Visalia phase, and he seemed to really cut down on that as he evolved.
These poor victims who are alive now must be reliving the horror now that they know this suspect has been arrested.
We've spoken to several of them, and the emotions are so mixed. There's happiness, of course. A lot of them figured that this day would never come. Some of them have passed on, and they didn't live to see this day.
This day. And again, he's just a suspect. But right. Let's go back to the calls. Deborah is in Visalia, California, west of the Rockies. Hi, Deborah.
Hello. How are you?
We are okay. Thank you. Go ahead, hon.
We had Morales Drive-In in Visalia. My mother worked there for many years, and I graduated from high school in 1970, and I went to work there. And all the policemen on the Visalia PD came in for their coffee breaks. And I vaguely remember, I'm trying to remember now, that I remember we couldn't park our cars in the back or walk to our cars when we closed by ourselves. The policeman told our boss that we had to park our cars where they could be seen from the windows. So I don't know if this something about a burglar or prowler. Prowler, that's what they called him. So anyway, I was thinking about the policeman that came in there. I don't want to say their names, of course, over the air, but I remember their names. And we saw them every day. I can't wait to find a picture of this man from that time, if he worked in Visalia at the Visalia PD, to see if I recognized him.
I got to know them.
My mother knew them all because she worked there for years.
I don't think he worked at that police department, Keith. Did he? He worked at Auburn and Exeter, didn't he?
He worked nearby. He worked up in Exeter, and obviously, he was in Visalia quite a bit. Whether his work overlapped with that area or not is unknown. It's unlikely that VPD knew him because one officer who was shot at by the offender did come face-to-face with him unmasked one night, and he didn't recognize him. And that says a lot about That area in Central California was notorious for being siloed off when it came to police departments anyway, even in homicide cases. So it's not completely surprising that they wouldn't recognize the suspect. It's also possible that he was disguised a little bit because his hair was described as very light-colored, and the suspect had dark hair. So it's interesting some of these things that we're trying to rectify because not everything lines up perfectly.
Well, in this suspect now at 72, the guy's bald,
right,
heavy, and doesn't look nearly like the artist's sketches from 30, 40 years ago.
Right, and we've been tracking down old photos of him. A lot of them have him as a mustache. Some suspicious persons in the areas of the attacks were described as having a mustache. And it's, but he really doesn't look like very many of the old composite sketches, and there's nearly 50 of them, and they run the gamut. Some of them are very different. And
could there have been more than one person?
Because of the tight MO and all of the things and the weird idiosyncrasies and the lack of financial gain in any of these attacks, it's very likely that there was only one offender. Now, as this situation develops, we may learn quite a few things that will surprise us. And I'm all for that.
I would just love it if this guy would just say, I'm guilty, and this is what I did, this is why I did it, and lays it all out for everybody.
It would be best for the public, for the victims, just rip the Band-Aid off. And in a way, that would be him taking, even though he's lost control of his life, he'd be able to take control one last time and control his narrative one last time.
Would they give him life in prison if he copped a plea?
I would imagine in a situation like that, bargaining would be on the table, something like that. I don't know. Now, there are a lot of district attorneys and a lot of jurisdictions involved, and there are politics at play, and it's hard to say what will happen.
How'd you like to be his court-appointed attorney? Jeez.
No, thank you.
No. Let's go next to Michael in South Georgia, trucking on the wild card line. Go ahead, Michael.
Hey, George. I want to kind of play devil's advocate here, but before I do, I want to say in my own defense, if the guy's proven guilty, I believe in swift and just punishment on the bat.
I get it.
Okay. But on the devil's advocate, you and both your guests have said something that I've heard all my life, and I've yet to see anybody proven guilty by that scenario. And that's that he must have had something done to him as a child.
Yeah, I've been saying that. That's right.
How can that be? Because I've known people who've been sent to prison. I know a guy who went around picking up kids and telling them he was a preacher and beating them in the head with a brick and a Bible. But he was pampered as a child growing up. He had everything he could ever want. And he still committed these
crimes. Oh, yeah, there's no doubt. I mean, some of these people are sick from the get-go. What I meant was a lot of times when younger kids are mentally and physically abused, they literally go insane. And they create things later in life when they're adults that lashes back at what they think they're lashing back at. So the victims may be the people that he thinks abused him when he was a child. You want to jump in here, Keith?
Yeah, a lot of times it goes to what the we'll just call him the offender, what the offender perceives as people doing to him. People may be punishing him in the same way that they punish other children, and the other children take it in stride and learn from it. The offender may be broken in his mind in such a way that he sees this as he's being victimized because he couldn't possibly have done anything wrong, or he's being unfairly singled out. In fact, there's an interesting piece of paper that was found near one of the later attacks called the Mad is the Word essay. And it's a rant somebody wrote. And it was found at the end of a bloodhound trail that the East Area Rapist had left. So the assumption is that it's his work. And it talks about a sixth-grade teacher who just infuriates him because he took away field trips and he made him write sentences for talking in class. And that's normal school stuff. But this whoever wrote that essay took that to the extreme. And he talks about his hands aching and feeling emasculated by this experience. And this teacher was just, it sounds like this teacher was just doling out normal punishment. But this offender or whoever wrote the essay did not take it that way. And it could be something normal to some people, but this offender took it the wrong way, took it personally.
We'll take a few more calls here before the clock gets us. Let's go to Pamela in Lincoln, California. Hi, Pam. Go ahead.
Yikes. How are you, George?
Good. I'm fine. Thank you.
Thank you. Bless the people and comfort for their loss and horrific pain. I want to say that right off the bat. And amazing how many people he has violated on many levels. I was born and raised in Sacramento, California. I worked in Citrus Heights at Marie Callender's. And when this all came down, I remember how frightened I was to leave Marie's at night and go home to Carmichael in my apartment. I'd sit in my car, look out, make sure it was clear, and I'd bolt into my apartment. My Papa Jim would bring dowels and put them in my windows. How ironic, if this guy was a police officer, he had an arsenal of tricks that now I look back and go, wow, that's nothing. Back then I thought, wow, I'm safe. But shortly after that, I moved to Calabasas in 78 through 79.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really strange. I left some friends, and it was getting rainy, very warm rain. I had a cowboy hat on. And that's important. And when I got out of my car, here was this guy standing there. And you know what? I looked at this sketch today, and I went, oh, it was just creepy.
Too close. Too close.
It was kind of creepy. And anyway, he forced me back to my Camaro, and I, like an angel, kept saying, he forced me back into the Camaro to go on the driver's side over to the passenger side, and I kept hearing a voice, it's hard to get out of a Camaro. And as soon as he sat down, I bolted, ran through this monster apartment complex in Calabasas, and finally started banging on doors. Somebody let me in, called the police. We went back to my car, still pouring rain. My cowboy hat was on the outside my car, and the turquoise beads were gone. But I don't know.
If they find turquoise beads in his house, you're going to creep out.
Yeah, I don't want them back.
you don't want them back. You may have been very lucky there, Pam.
You know what? Again, yes, I was very, very fortunate and very lucky. But again, and back to, that dog spray you were talking about?
Yeah.
Repellent? I think, personally, dog repellent is pepper spray. And getting back to people who have horrible upbringings and childhood and whatnot, I didn't have peaches and cream. But you know what? I know what's right and I know what's wrong.
Yeah, you sure do. Thanks for the story, Pam. I wonder how many of the 50 victims who were molested, I wonder how many he attempted.
They talk about an offender like this being a lion on the prowl. And the lion chases after and stalks a lot of prey, and his success rate is actually fairly low. So we look at an offender like this, and we look at the burglaries he's suspected of committing in the Sacramento area and everywhere else, which totals up to about 125, and you wonder how many of those people were potential victims. Some of them did become victims. So was that part of his way of scouting out the layout of a residence, looking through people's personal photos and deciding, is this a place that I want to attack? And how many unreported attacks might there be? And you look at all of these things because he was such a prolific offender. And
now they never killed the Zodiac killer.
Yeah, they never found him.
Is that possible? Could he have been involved in that too?
That's been floated by. It looks unlikely, especially now that we've gotten identification. There's nothing that really seems to indicate a connection there. It looks like they're two different offenders, which means that there's two different sadistic killers out there. And there's actually a lot more from that era and in that area. But it would be nice to tie more of these crimes together. But I think we're lucky to even bring in the Visalia case into this one and wrap that one up.
Now, in this case, were there any letters sent to newspapers by the person, by the suspect?
There were a few. We don't know if they were sent by him or not.
Or some copycat.
We'll find out. There was one really stupid poem.
I saw that online today. It was ridiculous.
Yes. So right. Whether that was him or whether that was somebody goofing around, we don't know at this point. Hopefully those are one of the things that, that we'll find out.
Keith, stay in touch with us. Let us know what happens in this investigation, and let's do some updates as time permits, okay?
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on and for the support that Coast to Coast has given this case. It really makes a huge difference when media gets involved like this.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. Up next, Jason Miller joins me as we talk about sorcery. Next.